You're listening to KHEN LPFM Radio 106.9 Salida, Colorado. And this is Truth Quest with Melody. And we're streamed on the internet at khen.org. And if you would like to listen to tonight's program or any past programs of Truth Quest with Melody, they're available at www.gimmesometruth.info or link from the khen.org website. And I'm Melody, and my co-host tonight is Dr. Eric Carlstrom. And our special guest tonight is Rosalind Peterson. And Dr. Eric Carlstrom is a professor of geography at California State University, Stanislaus, with nearly 30 years teaching experience. His academic research has focused on using soils and landforms as a means of reconstructing climates and environmental conditions of the past. And before introduce our guest, the views expressed on this program are those of myself and or my guests and do not necessarily reflect the views of the KHEN staff, volunteers, or board of directors. And tonight we have back a really special researcher and guest, and I'm going to let her describe herself again, even though her credentials are quite great for the subject that we're going to have tonight. And this is Rosalind Peterson again, who has a website, californiaskywatch.com. And are you there, Rosalind and Dr. Carlstrom?
Yes, I'm here.
Yes, I'm here, Melody.
Okay, great. And did you have anything more you wanted to add on your experience, Rosalind?
Well, one of the things that, of the many subjects that we may discuss here this evening, is I wanted to talk about my background with agriculture. And I worked for the United States Department of Agriculture in California. And what I did is I was a crop loss adjuster, which meant that I traveled to 10 counties in the state of California checking on crop losses in the state for about 50,000 miles of driving a year, doing this adjusting for the state. And during that period of time, I had become concerned that weather modification and other programs may be interfering with the microclimates that allow for the production of agriculture, the amount of rainfall, and the amount of snow that we need in order to produce crops in California and elsewhere in the United States. So I just wanted to make sure that my background here comes from agriculture and crop production so that your audience would know that a lot of the things that I've been studying and researching are based on preserving the food we eat and the amount of food that is produced in the United States, and that when we interfere with that in artificial ways, then that's going to impact all of us in the short term and in the long term.
Well, Rosalind, if I could jump in on that note, you mentioned you were working with the USDA as a crop loss adjuster. What years are you talking about when you started to notice the possible effects of weather modification on agriculture in California?
Well, it was after I had retired. I started in 2002 to really come into understanding that weather modification was really taking place in the state of California and other western states, and began to really understand that we had been modifying our skies with man-made clouds, which was interfering with direct sunlight reaching the earth, which could reduce crop production in the United States and in California. And so I was contacted by several agricultural producers that I had met along the way who were very concerned because their crop production was dropping or they were having drought conditions and didn't know why. And so we had discussed this on numerous occasions, and that's when I started to really heavily research in weather modification areas.
Okay. Now, you talk about man-made clouds and reduction of solar radiation or sunlight. There are other people that have noticed a phenomenon called global dimming, and I've heard figures of, say, 20% less sunlight over a period of some like 20 years. Does that sound about right to you?
Yes, there's less sunlight definitely now reaching the Earth than in, say, 50 to 100 years ago. And we're beginning to interfere with the amount of that sunlight reaching the Earth. And one of the things that has happened in the last 20 years has been the introduction of persistent jet contrails that produce man-made clouds, which, according to NASA, aggravate and exacerbate global warming, change our climate. They produce a white haze, and they impact natural resources in a negative way. So we do have the NASA studies and the IPCC studies from the United Nations saying that aviation is having a critical effect on, in other words, our climate.
Now, you just mentioned the IPCC, and that, I believe, stands for the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, which is a United Nations, actually a political body. It's comprised of government representatives, and they go out and find scientists to write their assessment reports, and they have four of them now. Most recent one came out in 2007. And these IPCC reports are the basis for the global warming scare, or at least a big part of the global warming scare that the media and the politicians have picked up on. Now, I'll just mention that last week we had an interview with Dr. Tim Ball here with Melody, and we've had two prior interviews with him. I've also done a lot of research on this whole issue of climate change over long periods, and really, we old timers like Tim Ball and myself and some of the other people that have studied climate change, natural climate change over the not just centuries but millennia and millions of years timescales, we are quite certain that this whole man-caused global warming thing is pretty bogus in the sense that there's really very, very little data to support the idea that humans have caused and are causing the climate to increase in kind of an abnormal way. In fact, we see very little warming, and probably the humans burning fossil fuels has contributed to very, very tiny fraction, if any, of that. But anyway, I say all that simply because the IPCC is the political United Nations political body which has promoted this idea of man-caused global warming, and given the politicians the leverage, the so-called data support they need to introduce the energy bill, the cap and trade policies, etc. Now, going back, you said the IPCC also made some comments about these persisting jet contrails, is that correct?
Yes, they've talked about, there's a book called Aviation and the Global Atmosphere, and they talk about water vapor as a greenhouse gas, and they talk about the impact of having water vapor in certain areas, like Alaska, which definitely has an impact in other words, keeping things warmer, kind of a blanket over the Earth in those areas. And they're talking about increasing levels of water vapor over Alaska and the Arctic, which would actually cause them to hold heat in and melt more rapidly. Now, and one of the things that they talk about is that the persistent jet contrails tend to form this cloud cover, man-made cloud cover, and white haze. They consist of water vapor and ice crystals, and what they do is they can hold the heat in certain areas. So you could have some climate change in other words, this increase in cloud cover. And so we're concerned about this because we think that it's also blocking direct sunlight from reaching the Earth. And this cloud cover, when it blocks direct sunlight from reaching the Earth, negatively impacts crop production. Now, we know that from University of Illinois and other studies that have been done recently, that without direct sunlight, you have a lack of photosynthesis and your plants don't grow as well. So the problem in some areas is that once you start cutting off the amount of direct sunlight reaching the Earth, which is a suggestion for these geoengineering schemes, to put up particles or to put up things in the sky, in other words, carbon black, for example, or sulfur, different types of chemicals. Some of them you would find when a volcano goes off, in order to cool us down, have negative effects because they can lead to acid rain, and they can also block the direct sunlight reaching the Earth, which could lower crop production and causes other difficulties as well. And when you have increased cloud cover, you do change the climate. And when you change the climate artificially, then you begin to upset the microclimates needed for crop production to take place. And you can change, when you add this process to weather modification programs, which are ongoing in the United States and in California and Colorado and Idaho and Wyoming, when you and Nevada, another state that's modifying its weather a lot, then you begin to change agricultural production in those areas. And our government agencies don't want to talk about this. And so this is part of the area that I'm really researching in, is this area of how we're modifying or planning to modify what we do in our atmosphere. In other words, so that we stop direct sunlight from or reduce the amount of direct sunlight reaching the Earth. And I have grave concerns about that because we do need vitamin D and we do need direct sunlight in order to reduce molds, mildews, and fungus, and also to allow direct sunlight to come down and allow for the plants and trees to gain the energy they need to grow and produce crops.
Well, of course, we know that the entire biosphere runs on sunlight. That's the energy source for all living things, pretty much, except for a few life forms that are near the ocean, deep sea ocean heat vent. But, you know, 99.9% of all the energy to the planet, which drives the weather systems, drives the biosphere, is from the sun. So if we start to tamper with the amount of incoming solar radiation deliberately, this doesn't sound good. This doesn't sound like a good thing. Let me just, before I ask the next question, let me just link back to the clouds. Now, I teach climatology and introduction to physical geography and that sort of thing. And we teach that about 50% of the globe is covered with clouds at any given time. Clouds occur in many different types, the low level, the middle level, and the high level clouds. And clouds have been one of the things that the computer modelers, the climate modelers, have not been able to model successfully because they are so complex. And but in general, one of the things that has come from the studies in climate change and global warming, et cetera, is that low clouds, like cumulus clouds, which are very bright on the top, tend to reflect sunlight back and therefore would have a cooling effect on the Earth. But high clouds, like the cirrus clouds, which are in the upper part of the atmosphere or upper part of the troposphere, would tend to absorb heat from the Earth just like a greenhouse gas, and then tend to hold in the heat like a blanket. Mm-hmm. So a lot of the modelers were caught and very puzzled, saying, well, we know clouds are the wild card in terms of predicting what future climate's going to be, and it kind of depends on whether we have more cumulus clouds, which are the low clouds that reflect sunlight, or the cirrus clouds, which absorb heat radiation given from the Earth. So it would seem that if these man-made clouds mimic cirrus clouds, then they would have the effect of actually trapping in heat and warming the Earth. Now, does that sound right to you?
Absolutely. And the clouds that we are talking about are cirrus clouds. They are the higher clouds.
This is
of great concern to NASA and some universities in studying this in recent years, because they really feel that there's more of these man-made clouds. at the higher level that are produced by jets, and that this is not good for us because it doesn't allow the heat to escape from the Earth as readily.
What part does the this play in the ability to utilize solar energy with the equipment that we have these days?
Well, a friend of mine who lives in Shasta County built a solar house, and one of the regions that's heavily hit by these man-made clouds on a pretty consistent basis year-round is Shasta County near Redding. And what's happening there is his solar panels lose production when these man-made clouds are present, to the point where sometimes he's almost dependent on electricity for running his house versus being a place where solar would run his house all of the time without any use of electricity at all. So this has really changed his thinking on this, because when the man-made cloud cover is over, covering the skies, cirrus clouds, white haze, all of this, his solar production can drop up to 50-60% at times.
Yeah, I would just mention that this is one of the articles that you sent me, Melody, by Dane Wigington in Shasta County in August 11, 2007, called Diminished Solar Charge Capacities Due to Persistent Jet Contrails. Now, he does have a background as an electrical engineer, and he's got a lot of experience trying to get solar with solar off-grid electricity production. And he's been thwarted in his attempts by the degree of artificial cloud cover created by these persisting contrails, sometimes called chemtrails. So, and I would just mention at this point that there are now several good DVDs and videos available on this subject, and I just ordered three. One's called Skylines, which is a short documentary by Deborah J. Whitman. This one mostly documents what's going on in California, and it also features Rosalind Peterson. The other one, and this is coming mostly out of the California Skywatch group, I believe. There's another one called Geoengineering by the New York Skywatch group, which is also extremely informative and actually more technical in terms of explaining what could be going on in terms of weather warfare capacity technologies. And then there is a recent History Channel program called Weather Warfare, which aired in July of 2009, 45 minutes long, which is excellent, showing how the weather can be used for purposes of warfare, and our government has certainly been interested in these potentials for a long time. All those can be bought at Sophia Small Storm's website, and perhaps Rosalind can tell us where else they can be got. And this guy, Dane Wigington, who is the electrical engineer concerned about solar energy, he is featured on the Sky Lines video, talking to a group up in Shasta County, kind of, it looks like a county board of supervisors, trying to get the county board of supervisors to analyze the water for the heavy metal content. Maybe could you tell us a little bit about those attempts, Rosalind, to try to get county and state officials to wake up to what's happening here?
Yes, I can. I do know that that's a Board of Supervisors meeting in Shasta County that Dane was speaking about, and they've been finding very high levels of aluminum and barium, strontium, and other chemicals in snow samples and drinking water samples, as well as pond samples in that area. And I did a research and obtained from the California State Department of Health Drinking Water Division in Sacramento, California, a CD of all drinking water tests dating back to the 1970s, done in the state of California. It's about 18 million bytes of data. And those tests, anyone, by the way, can get a CD, get a copy of this information free from the California State Department of Health Drinking Water Division just upon request. It's very easy to get the data. And what happened was I did a study of the data to figure out if I could find what it was that people were talking about, what was spiking in drinking water supplies. And these tests are from every drinking water source in the state of California as required by law. So every county, every city, every drinking water source, whether it's a winery or a well, that provides water to the public for public consumption has to be tested under California and EPA regulations. So I took a look at all of that data, graphed a great deal of it, and what I found is we had unusually high spiking in barium, aluminum, manganese, magnesium, arsenic, strontium, and boron. There's a few other chemicals that are very odd to be spiking in. But the main spikes that started occurring were in the 1990s, around 1990, 1991. We began to see unusual spiking of these chemicals, all at the same time, would spike in almost every drinking water supply source in the state of California. And this coincided with other spikes that were occurring in other states as well. So we took all this data and put it into a graphing program, which took about 300 hours to do. And we really examined the spikes and the correlation between the spikes in different areas of California. And we can tell you that there's extremely high levels of aluminum and barium, manganese, magnesium, strontium, that are spiking in California drinking water supplies at various times. And we've correlated it to some atmospheric testing that has taken place that is being done by NASA and the Air Force in conjunction with the University of Alaska, that they've been putting up these canisters filled with these chemicals, superheating them, exploding them in the atmosphere and doing these atmospheric tests. And these tests of these chemicals that are put up in canisters by the space shuttle or by rockets are beginning to show up as spikes in drinking water supplies in many areas, and we think that the testing correlates with the spikes in our drinking water here in California.
Okay, well, you gave a clue there. You mentioned the University of Alaska, and we know that the University of Alaska is involved with the HARP facility, which could provide a tie-in for what is being done by the Air Force and NASA. Would you care to elucidate on that? Or do I need to?
Well, I think you're going to have to because I'm not an expert in HARP. I've refrained from going in that direction other than to know the bare minimum of what HARP does, but there's not a lot of documentation. There's some, but not a lot. And we don't know, because it's not public record, all of the different projects that they're engaged in. Although we do think that they were engaged in the recent Navy putting up a aluminum oxide cloud on the West Coast on September 19th. And we do think that they were engaged because of the reading I've done with that program. And we're doing some heating of the atmosphere possibly during that time period when this aluminum oxide dust cloud was put up into the atmosphere, and that there will be continued tests going on for the next several months with regard to that dust cloud that was put up.
What do you think they did that?
Well, let me just explain HARP before
okay.
we go that. A little bit. HARP is a series of about 360 towers, 72 feet high. HARP stands for the High Frequency Active Auroral Research Program. Now, of course, Alaska is a good place to study the aurora borealis because near the poles you have a lot of ions in the atmosphere, and these are electrically charged particles that give us the aurora borealis and the aurora australis in the southern hemisphere, etc. So HARP is a research facility with a number of co-sponsors, including the U.S. military, the Air Force, as well as private corporations. And they are using patents from a guy named Eastland that are pretty much identical technologies that Nikola Tesla discovered about 100 years ago that have to do with directed energy using different portions of the electromagnetic spectrum. What this can do with this array of 360 towers, they can send off pulses of extremely low frequency radiation. They can lift the ionosphere. They can send these pulses over the horizon. They can bounce it off the ionosphere because the ionosphere is one of the upper levels of the atmosphere, and radio waves bounce off the ionosphere. By sending these pulses of electromagnetic radiation, HARP can actually lift the ionosphere and create a bubble in it, thereby creating somewhat of a vacuum in the lower atmosphere, and then air has to rush into that. There's also a suggestion that HARP can could teleguide the jet stream, storms, could be involved in even mind control, because they talk about the frequency of brain waves being about the same as the potential frequencies that HARP can use. So anyway, the other movie, the geoengineering movie, was saying that one of the projects that is probably being conducted with these so-called chemtrails or persisting contrails is to lay a grid down of these chemicals, like you say, these metals, which then HARP can use to determine where to send the signals. And one of the goals would be perhaps to steer the jet stream and to deflect large storms. So if HARP, if the plane is putting down a contrail along a front boundary, that is a boundary between a warm front and a cold front or something like that, air masses of dissimilar air masses, then HARP could send the extremely low frequency energy pulses that could actually add energy to one side or the other and deflect the whole system. So this is one potential use of these jet contrails, is to allow HARP. It ionizes the atmosphere in a sense. It increases the electrical conductivity of the atmosphere with all these metals, and it allows the electromagnetic radiation to have more of an effect when it is directed in those areas. Does that sound roughly correct to you, Rosalind?
Yes, it does.
Can I ask, you say it's called a high frequency, but you're talking about low frequencies. Do you know why they, why would they call it high frequency and they're using low frequencies?
Well, it's High Altitude Aurora Research Program.
Okay, that's kind of what I thought it was, too.
So it's high altitude where they're doing research.
Okay.
Well, it's not a point that I can really add much to on that. But I can tell you that there are at least five such installations around the world. The one near Golconda, Alaska, is not the only one in the world. There's, I've heard, between 5 and 12 others. And so when you start to put all of these stations together, they have great potential for manipulating the upper atmosphere and our weather system. And of course, a lot of this is experimental, and a lot of it has potential military uses, or else the Air Force probably wouldn't be interested. Okay, so having said that about HARP, maybe we could get back to this Navy program that you were talking about, because you mentioned there was a connection with HARP there as well, Rosalind.
Well, what happens is that they want to know, in other words, there's ionospheric experiments going on all the time. The CRES program, C-R-R-E-S, NASA and the Air Force's CRES program, is doing these different ionospheric programs in order to study more and more about how the universe works. Well, this is all well and good, except that the chemicals they're using we think are beginning to show up back on Earth here and causing water pollution and soil pollution. In addition, the experiments, it's kind of interesting when you talk about the CARE experiment, because
the Navy CARE experiment.
Yeah, it's a charged aerosol release experiment, and the principal investigator, which is a Paul Bernhardt of the Naval Research Laboratory in Washington, D.C., they're talking about what kind of information you get back when you send out radar pulses into this aluminum oxide dusty plasma that they have created. And essentially, what they're doing is they're talking about having the CARE experiment paving the way for future launches of this type of, putting up this type of dusty particulate that would use the uppermost part of the Earth's atmosphere as a large physics laboratory for studying charged dust and other experiments. And this is what concerns me, because the environment that we live in other words, the ionosphere and all these different levels of protective cocoon that circles the Earth, if we start using them for experiments in a physics laboratory, we could destroy the very nature of life on Earth here if we were to disrupt one of those, because they're fragile and they're not tough like they would be resilient exactly. And the more experiments we do in those areas, the more likely it is that we can cause some harm to come to the Earth. And if we put up dusty plasmas and aerosols of different types that are going to eventually come down, we're going to disrupt the amount of sunlight that reaches the Earth. We could be doing other harm to the environment. No one knows. And so all of these experiments, no one is studying agriculture, no one is studying the amount of direct sunlight reaching the Earth that could be impacted by these tests. No one is really, they're looking at the experiment for the sake of using our atmosphere as a physics laboratory, but without our consent or in knowledge for the most part. And that's another great concern of mine.
Do questions come up in these meetings when they're talking about global warming? Does it ever come up that any of this is going on?
No. No, because you see, U.S. Senate Bill 1733, which is the new energy bill, it's the cap and trade bill, it's the reducing the carbon dioxide bill, essentially. When they go in and talk about this bill, more of it is about employing new nuclear power plants. It's about using our trees as credit offsets for polluters to give off more carbon dioxide and to be given or purchase these credits so that they can keep on polluting, which to me makes no sense at all. But when you talk about these other experiments that we're doing, whether it's weather modification experiments, whether it's these atmospheric experiments, whether it's persistent jet contrails that change the climate, that isn't in the bill. No one wants to talk about those subjects. Senator Kay Bailey Hutchison's U.S. Senate Bill 601 wants to allow more weather mitigation and modification by everyone without any public oversight or control or congressional oversight or public notification for that matter. So that's why we've been working to defeat that bill for the last several years each time she introduces it. So once again this year, for the first time, it's gotten out of committee and could be passed at any time. But
Yeah. It,
when you have U.S. Senate Bill 1733, which is an energy bill, but it's supposed to fix the climate and to reduce global warming, we don't talk about these other experiments that we're doing in the atmosphere, which could have an adverse effect or could be causing us some climate problems.
But they don't hesitate to kind of dump the blame on the public.
Yeah,
that's
right.
Correct. And what I think is happening here is that we can all say, yes, in other words, we pollute, we do different things. But then if that was the problem, then all they have to do is put the EPA in gear, find all the polluters, and use the money for less polluting alternative sources of energy and investment in new technology, And they could save their, they could do something about it relatively quickly, just like they did in the 70s and 80s. But that's not the goal here. The goal here is a market scheme. And it's nice to say to all of us, well, we all have to take personal responsibility, which I find fine. You know, creating less pollution is okay. But what happens is nobody is looking at the weather modification programs and the synergistic effect of these. There's over 60. The list is NOAA public listing, U.S. Department of Commerce listing that's public record. We don't know what the synergistic effects of those and how they're affecting agriculture and climate. And when we talk about man-made clouds and these cirrus clouds affecting climate and changing climate because these jets produce more of these clouds for whatever reason, they don't need to, then what we're doing is we're changing our climate. But you see, none of this is talked about in any of this legislation that is coming up. It's all talked about that there's only one culprit, carbon dioxide, when actually they've got six greenhouse gases. But they're not talking about that either. So the bill is disingenuous in many ways.
Well, it's fraudulent in many ways, I think. You know, and the thing that Dr. Ball and I and many of our colleagues would say about that is they've completely ignored the role of natural climate change. And we know enough about the past history of the Earth to know that natural climate changes are dramatic and much larger. They can be much larger than anything we've seen in the last few centuries. And so it's an attempt. I look at it now as a little bit like the book 1984. Remember, Winston Smith was with the Ministry of Truth, and it was his job to rewrite past newspaper articles to fit the present needs and dictates of Big Brother, who's of course the socialistic government of England, with the caveat or with the excuse that, you know, whoever controls the present controls the past. And so what we see with this whole climate research, quote-unquote, is that if we can control the funding, who gets funding for what, we can ignore the vast amount of research that's been done on paleoclimates, climates of the past, and rewrite the past to fit our present agenda, which becomes then a form of scientific censorship, which is what I'm feel like I'm struggling against, because this is the area of my research. And I've done a lot on past climates, and I know a lot about past climates, but it would seem that the so-called experts in control don't want to know anything about past climates. They want to think that there was no change in climate until humans started driving cars and burning fossil fuels. Well, that's just ludicrous. So I'm hoping that the emperor has no clothes will become increasingly obvious to people who still can think. But meanwhile, we've got these other issues which you're tackling, which I think really are of major significance and are very, very concerning. And I'll just say that John Holdren, our czar of science, has recently said, oh, the problems of global warming are so dramatic that we better start some geoengineering technologies to counter the runaway warming of the planet. And of course, this would be then a segue between the programs, I guess, would be, oh, now this gives us an excuse then to go ahead and continue to modify the weather like we've been doing for 20 years, only we're saying we're just starting it.
Well, that's absolutely correct. And also, we don't take into consideration that every so often volcanoes go off. And when they do go off, they release a lot of particles and chemicals into the atmosphere, some of which create acid rain. But they work toward cooling us down as well. So we don't know, because these different volcanoes and these different Earth events are also working to change, in other words, the climate, and to change what's happening with our environment. And so now all of a sudden we say, well, we have to take these Stanford University professors like Ken Caldera and Professor Benford of Irvine University are talking about using these experiments now that they've been playing with on their computer models to start to experiment with them more and more to determine how we can change the environment we live in by putting up particles, for example, in the atmosphere, so that we can do more of these charged particles like aluminum oxide and put them into the atmosphere so that they can conduct their experiments. I don't believe it's for our own benefit. I think it's for a military application and to continue funding their research from the Pentagon and other military sources of funding that the universities get now at this time more and more versus other types of funding which would be independent of the military complexes that are now highly engaged in this type of atmospheric physics experiments.
I believe in the geoengineering DVD that I just purchased, put out by New York Skywatchers.com.
Yes.
They showed an experiment in which you had a cloud or a bunch of water vapor and water droplets in a cylinder, and then they introduced some of these metals, aluminum oxide, barium, strontium, etc. And what they found was that the cloud dissipated, and the moisture dried up. And this, I think, gave them the idea that perhaps this is a way to create drought. This would be one of the potentials for this kind of addition of chemicals to the atmosphere, wouldn't it?
Absolutely. And that was talked about on the History Channel program as well, giving these experiments that they could do. And I thought that test actually was very revealing in the fact that this water vapor, dissipated. But I think that the experiments have been ongoing for some time. The public just hasn't been made aware of them. And now it's come time that they want to roll through the global warming crisis so that they can begin to really come forward with public knowledge about these programs and that the public will think that it's so beneficial that they wouldn't object. And I think that that's been the objective.
Do you have any idea how long Colorado has had a weather modification department?
Ooh, I don't know. I would imagine since NOAA arrived and put headquarters in Colorado, and I'm not sure when that was. I'm sure that they could give you a history of that very easily. The NOAA people could give you a history of that. But they've been modifying the weather in Colorado going back to the 1940s, as far as I know. That's the earliest research records I have for Colorado.
And do you know of many other states that have it?
Yes, almost all the western states, with the exception of the state of Washington, because of treaty agreements with Canada. I don't have any that they're doing. I don't have any that Oregon are participating in at the present time. And let's see, Arizona does not seem to be participating at the present time in any of these weather modification programs. However, the rest of the states, California, Nevada, Colorado, Wyoming, Texas, all the other states, Montana, are all having some weather modification programs ongoing every year. According to U.S. Department of Commerce records, I can send those to you if you need them.
Okay, and wouldn't some of these programs offset each other? In a sense, you could almost have weather warfare among those that have these programs.
Yes, because when they instituted in Wyoming the biggest weather modification, it's a five-state, $10 million a year program, and it involves five states. And they decided to put more snow in the Wyoming mountains starting in the winter of 2006 than ever before in recorded history. And they have done that. But what they started to do from that was put surrounding counties in Wyoming into drought status. And also Colorado has now been having more droughts than ever before, even though they've increased the number of their weather modification programs. And when Ken Salazar was a senator, I discussed that with his office quite strenuously, that Wyoming snowpack project, which actually was designed to take all of the extra water runoff from the snowpack and supplement water in Southern California. That was the goal. Maybe, and it still is the goal, actually. That Colorado started to have more drought and more problems. And I was concerned that the people of Wyoming and the people of Colorado wouldn't know about the weather modification programs in that state and not understand why their weather was so different and why they were in these droughts or had too much rain or too much snow in some areas. And so that's one of the reasons that I started to object to these experimental weather modification programs, because the people weren't even notified. They're not. There is no U.S. requirement to notify the people, nor state requirement, except a limited in Texas, that requires anybody to be notified that these programs are taking place.
Well, one of the things that there's a group of us that have kind of looked at certain events taking place around the country, and we started noticing that sometimes there was a weather overage of either drought or rain in some of these places, that there might have been some commercial interests or governmental interests that could be interfering. Are you following what I'm talking about? Say, like with the Trans-Texas Corridor, it was interesting that for that month about a year or two ago, it was like there was a front that, you know, parked itself there for almost a month. And then when Coca-Cola was having some things going on with the Georgia, they were going through a drought. They were going over having problems with feuding over the water, if I understand it correctly.
Well, the only thing is that anyone can modify your weather at this particular point in time. Any individual, any company, any state, any city, any county, anyone. I could hire somebody today to go and modify the weather over Colorado if I chose to, or over anyone. And I could disperse your clouds. I could put chemicals up, any type of chemical, any type of ground-based chemical, airborne chemical. I could put anything into the air I wanted, even experimentally, and there would be no restriction against it. And so I could do what the Dynagel Dynamat Corporation did and took a polymer and put it into an airplane and sprayed it into clouds, and the polymer soaked up the moisture in the clouds, dissipated the clouds, and the gel fell to Earth, which has detrimental effect to living things on Earth. But what happens is that right now, unless we get control of this particular problem, we're going to face more and more of this in the future, and also the HAARP project could superheat, for example, air masses, or they could put up carbon black as a particulate up into the air and superheat it, and could create weather fronts. And you can change temperature. They know that changing temperature can hold a front in one place for a long period of time. So I actually think that we're experimenting in many, many ways in using the atmosphere as this physics laboratory, mostly for military use later. But I really think that we're experimenting on us at the present time.
Rosalind, are you familiar with a video or DVD by Tom Bearden called Soviet Weather Engineering Over North America, which he made in 1985. It's a talk he did in 1985 where he talks about using HAARP-like Tesla technology that the Soviets were apparently, according to him, using all through the Cold War. While we were so concerned about nuclear technology, they were moving right into Tesla technology, which actually is potentially much more destructive. Are you familiar with that movie?
I never saw the movie, so I'm not familiar with
the
movie.
He talks about the woodpecker signals that they would send, and they'd do these over the horizon radio waves and electromagnetic, extremely low frequency pulses, and that they could divert our jet stream, and they could create storms in certain areas, and that they were doing it. And he gives lots of examples. So I think that's something you might want to check out at some point, because if this is true, the U.S. government was playing catch-up to the Soviets during the late 80s, and the Soviets were ahead of us when they fell apart in 1989.
Well, I do know that they were using Project Woodpecker. The only thing that I cannot lay my hands on are the actual documents that would hold up in a court of law. And that's what I try to look for when I start talking about these projects, are the actual documents that would hold up.
Right.
So that they're not just theories.
Yes.
I can back them up with some credibility.
Right.
And that's harder. There's a lot of speculation, and there's some things that they speculate about what was done. But sometimes I can't get to the document itself or the series of documents which really show exactly how it was done and what it and what was done and when.
Right.
So that's that. So I try to separate that out a little bit.
Well, I think that that's a connection, perhaps, with HAARP and with Tesla technology that we should be considering, because you know, Tesla said if he interfered two electromagnetic waves of just the right frequency, he could split the Earth in two. So we're talking about the power to create earthquakes. We're talking about power to move hurricanes. We're talking about power to create huge earthquakes, and even potentially to, as Tesla said, split the Earth in two. So technology potentially more powerful than any nuclear technology that we know of. Now, if I could shift gears, I got this great little card here. It's called the Independent Thinkers, quote, Chemtrails Fact Sheet. Have you seen that?
No.
Okay, this comes out of www.aboutthesky.com. I got it from Sophia Smallstorm's website. And it's 10 points here, and I wonder if I could just kind of go through these real quick and get your comments about them. I think it gives some of the high points. It starts out with pictures of what you're calling persisting contrails, or persisting jet contrails. Some people call them chemtrails. And it says, have you noticed airplanes leaving white plumes in the sky, often in grids? These trails widen and spread out, forming layers that look like clouds. Soon the sky is overcast. Here are 10 points to consider about this phenomenon. Number one, current U.S. Senate bills are seeking to pass weather modification and weather experimentation policies to engineer and control our weather. And you've already mentioned U.S. Senate Bill 601, which you identified as the Kay Bailey Hutchison bill.
That's correct.
Yeah, and you've already mentioned that. Number two, the jets that spray aerosols in the sky have been seen all over the world. No governments or official agencies have been willing to discuss this activity. Now, I've seen some reports that say this is mostly going on in NATO countries, i.e., Europe, North America, Australia, New Zealand, and then I've heard other people say it's all over the world. What is your understanding of that?
My understanding of that from talking to people is that it's more heavily used, I think, in the NATO countries, although I have people from Mexico and South America calling me, and from countries that are not involved with NATO as well. So, and they send me pictures, which tells me that it's going on almost all over.
Okay.
The one sentence I want to say is that when anyone says that something is being sprayed, and that there's a spraying going on, I can't prove if anything is being sprayed. I can't prove what it is. I have no way to prove that. I would love to, but I have no way to prove that they're spraying something, and what the something is that there's that these jets would be spraying to make contrails persist. I can't go there because I can't prove what or who, and that is the sticky issue there.
Well, let me just say that the geoengineering film is a little more bold as to say that there are 740 U.S. Air Force jets that are that are unmarked that are available for this, and they include KC-135s, which in fact are old Boeing 707s that can hold 130,000 gallons of liquid. They also include KC-10s or DC-10 airlines, which can hold twice that amount, and that these planes can hold between 10,000 pounds and a half a million pounds of metals, and that they are probably Air Force vehicle. Is that a little too bold for you as a statement?
Only about the number. I can't prove a number.
Uh-huh.
And I can't prove which branch of the military. I suspect it may be the Air Force, but I can't prove the branch of the military. If they're spraying something, definitely it would be showing up in the water supplies across the state of California, because the jets are working over California quite heavily. And the test results from the water supplies, and I have the current ones even for this year, and I can find the spikes, which are unusual and go up, but then I find too many zeros, which leads me to believe that either and I can find other sources of the chemicals that are showing up in our drinking water spikes. So I'm having a hard time correlating what the jets may be doing.
Okay, well, the point number three is that the content of the sprays includes fibers, metal particles, and biological elements, including fungi, many of which are microscopic. These microparticles enter our bodies, eluding our immune systems and impairing our health. Some of the particles are artificially engineered and self-replicating. Could you comment on that?
I can't prove it. The only thing I can prove is that all the branches of the military service release flares and chaff. Chaff is aluminum-coated fiberglass that they use for tracking weather patterns and also for disrupting radar. Now, chaff, the particulates from chaff are coming down. They float in the air for about 20 hours, and then they do come down, and the Air Force readily admits that they use chaff. The other branches of military in other countries also readily admit that they use chaff. So chaff is something that the Air Force and the Navy and the branches of the service release about 500 tons a year worldwide. And so we do know that. I can prove that.
Let me go ahead and do a station ID. This is KHENLPFM Radio, 106.9 Salida, Colorado, community-supported radio. And we're streamed on the Internet at khen.org. And we are past programs like tonight's, and the one that was referred to earlier with Dr. Tim Ball is on www.givemesometruth.info. And our co-host tonight is Dr. Eric Carlstrom, and our guest is Rosalind Peterson, and we're talking about chemtrails and naval experimentation and numerous other related subjects. Okay.
Yeah, let me just go back to this 10 points. But before I do that, I'll just mention some of the websites that are mentioned on this card. In addition to www.aboutthesky.com, there is also carnicom.com, newyorkskywatch.com, bariumblues.com, don'tchemtrailmebro.com, iclines.com, and then, of course, there's the californiaskywatch.com, which is your website, Rosalind.
It shouldn't be on that card.
It's not on this card, and you say it shouldn't be on the card because?
Because some of the statements therein I cannot prove.
Okay.
And
okay.
So I try to keep what I can prove separate from what other people may speculate on or believe based on ground-based tests. But a lot of ground-based tests could show a lot of things that are in the air, and you could find all kinds of things floating around. So I don't know that they're directly related to the jets.
Right.
So I have to stick with what I can prove.
Okay, very good. That's fair enough, and we appreciate that. I will say carnicom.com does go into the fibers and the biological elements, the fungi, et cetera, more. Okay, number four here is the metals in the sprays are ionized, electrically charged. The air we live in now is a plasma, able to conduct energy. It has been weaponized. Would you agree with that?
I think that there are some experiments, like the Navy CARE experiment, that are ongoing, which talk about negative and positive charge particle experiments, which is one of their experiments with the CARE program. So I can say that, yes, they are experimenting, and we don't know what the health effects are from being exposed to those type of particles, especially when they're aluminum oxide particles.
Yeah. I recall from our last interview you did say that with these metals in the water conducts electricity better, and the same would also be true of the air, wouldn't it?
Yes, it would, and that
okay.
could be why we're having more lightning strikes
yeah.
than ever in recorded history in many areas of the United States.
Well, this is what this guy, Dane Wigington, is talking about, and he's, of course, an electrical engineer. He's talking about the electrical potential of the atmosphere being some four times greater than it was before, as I recall from his article there.
Yes.
Yeah. Okay, number five here is the spraying has saturated our atmosphere with particulate matter that has whitened our once blue sky. Visibility on the Earth has been greatly reduced. A direct data-based correlation exists between particulate levels in the air and our mortality. Would you agree with that? Because you talked about rickets showing up in the last couple decades in much greater numbers than prior. Is that right?
Well, if you take jet fuel emissions, that would increase asthma in children in the United States. Jet fuel emissions are highly toxic. Soot particles, much like diesel trucks, carcinogens are released by the jets. So you have jet fuel emissions, which could be the source of many of those particulates and soot and different things that they release as part of the normal process of operating airplanes and jet engines. So I can say that from the source of jet fuel emissions and EPA reports in that regard. So, yes. Now, as far as rickets, that's a lack of vitamin D, and that's when you obscure... in other words, the sun from hitting the earth, then you have, you start to interfere with us getting enough vitamin D when we're outside because we are in cloud cover a lot of times. So the increase in rickets, even the CDC and the University of California Berkeley studies will say that that's from more cloud cover. And so children are not getting the vitamin D that they did years ago when they used to play outside because we're having this cloud cover put up by these jets producing these persistent contrails that produce the man-made clouds. And water vapor right there can be one of the culprits in that, too. And it would be reflective as well.
Well, I guess I should mention, as a guy who teaches about this stuff, that... when you put particulates in the atmosphere, and of course there are natural particulates in the atmosphere, soot and little pieces of dirt and whatnot, little floaties that get in the atmosphere, these little particulates, natural or man-injected, all have the same ability to act as what we call condensation nuclei, around which water vapor condenses into water droplets. And when water vapor condenses into water droplets, and you get enough of them, you have a cloud. And so there is a direct correlation then between the amount of particulates in the atmosphere and the cloud cover. And, of course, this is the basis of cloud seeding, which has been going on since the 40s and 50s. So, okay, we'll move on to number six here. Dangerous levels of aluminum and barium have been found in soil and water samples nationwide. Both elements are highly toxic. Our rate of respiratory illness, allergies, Alzheimer's, and cancer has risen exponentially since the spraying was intensified in 1998.
I think that the persistent jet contrails actually began to show up around the late 1980s, 1988, 1989. So it's been a much longer period of time. And so I would say that, yes, we've had spikes in aluminum and barium, but I can't directly associate them with a JET program.
Okay, how about associating them with our rate of respiratory illness, allergies, Alzheimer's, and cancer?
I think that all of our atmospheric experiments, including having more persistent jet contrails that expand, I think that all of those started to increase around the late 1980s, around the same time that we began to see the jets leaving persistent contrails. But also that's when other atmospheric experiments were taking place with NASA and with the U.S. Air Force. So they all started, there began to be a whole series of experiments at different levels doing different things that I think have all contributed to some of our problems since the late 1980s. And that includes increases in asthma in children. That includes the increase in rickets. Lots of things started to change, and air quality started to degrade about that time rather rapidly.
And we've heard speculation that aluminum, concentrations of aluminum, may be one of the causes for Alzheimer's disease. Is that correct?
It may be, and there are some studies which reflect this, and there seems to be some conflicting reports, but prior to the time that aluminum appeared in our drinking water, we seem to have fewer cases of Alzheimer's and some of these other diseases that are now showing up. So I think you have to look at the dates that these really started to show up in the population. In other words, the more general population. And I think that 1988 was a key year for that, along with the changes in forest fire configuration.
Okay. Okay, and then number seven is the spraying is a global covert operation. It is capable of engineering and controlling storms, planetary moisture, and the Earth's electrical balance. It can manipulate radio frequencies and the electromagnetic spectrum for military and surveillance purposes. It can alter human awareness and behavior.
I can't comment because I don't have the direct documents which would take me down that path precisely. And so I'm not even going to comment on that one because I can't relate it all to the jets. I think there's other experiments going on would affect us in that manner.
Yeah. Well, of course, this would implicate HARP. Now let me just mention a couple other resources for people who are interested in following up, and I just happen to have these books. There's a guy named Bob Fracekas, who is a journalist. He's got a book called The Fracekas Files, Star Wars, Weather Mods, and Full Spectrum Dominance. There is a book about HARP by Jerry E. Smith. It's called HARP, The Ultimate Weapon of the Conspiracy. And then there's a book by William Thomas, Chemtrails Confirmed, and another book by Jerry E. Smith called Weather Warfare, The Military's Plan to Draft Mother Nature. So there are others who certainly make those connections, and those are some of the books that would talk about it. Okay, then there's number eight. The spraying typically creates cloud-like masses that spread to form a, quote, sky shield. This sky shield is responsible for, quote, global dimming, now being presented as an antidote to global warming. According to NASA, the world has already seen a 20% loss of sunlight. Okay, we talked about that, and that we can kind of agree on. Is that right?
Yes, but they still refer to the jets spraying something, and I would certainly like to know what it is that they are spraying.
Yeah.
And I'd like to have, you know, if anyone has the government documents, anything that would hold up in court, I would be happy to take a look at it because this is the kind of documentation I'm looking for.
But the problem, of course, is these operations are classified, and the government, the military does not admit that chemtrails exist, per se, and does not admit to these programs. Isn't that much of the case?
That is the case, and that's why even when you deal with things that you can prove, our elected officials don't want to touch this topic. They don't want to touch aviation. So the Air Force has done a good job at preventing any of our elected officials into really looking into the programs that they might be engaged in, or it's so classified that when they're briefed, they can't talk about it.
Yeah. Yeah, that's great. And I think some of this stuff is probably classified at levels that are above our congressmen, which is an interesting commentary right there, that we have people who whose clearance levels are greater than our congressmen. In other words, who's running the show here? Number nine, HARP, and here they do define it, Melody, as the High Frequency Active Auroral Research Program, is a military surveillance operation that generates electromagnetic frequencies. The combination of HARP activity and the atmospheric spraying may be producing, quote, climate change, a phenomenon blamed on nature's response to, quote, runaway global warming. Our environment is deliberately being altered. Okay, so that that connection we've talked about a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
And then finally, number 10, these programs are operating without our informed consent. Their agenda may be the total control of biology, ecology, and the Earth. To this end, our, quote, destructive human ways, burning fossil fuels and overpopulation, may become the pretext to re-engineer nature as a means towards planetary, quote, sustainability. And that's a very interesting possibility, but I don't imagine you want to touch that one either, huh?
I'll touch it. Sure.
Okay.
I don't disagree with it, except to the fact that I don't think that they're going to engineer us into sustainability.
Right.
I think that it's for war purposes and full spectrum dominance, which is one of the military's, Air Force's favorite phrases. And so I think that this has got to do with wars in space. I think this has got to do with, in other words, this military aspect of it. And I think that a lot of the universities are now geared toward working toward these experiments with the for military applications. So I'm not so sure that they want to sustain us as much as they want to conduct their experiments. And they've got the money and the technology now to do it without any government public oversight to any great respect. The other thing is that, and it's irritating to me, is that not all of our elected officials that go to Washington, D.C., and that is our senators or our congressmen, are briefed on all of these issues. You have to have special clearances, and only one or two or three may be briefed. How do we know that we can trust them that if something is wrong, that they would speak up? Because under the Supreme Court decision, Senator Gravel and all of our senators since that time, he won his lawsuit, and the Supreme Court said that he could talk about classified, any senator could talk about classified material that they were going to vote on the floor of the Senate. But our senators are either given the material and our congressmen, and they can't talk about it even to their colleagues or to anyone. So therefore, if they object to it or have any comments, they can't represent us. The rest of them are not given the information, and therefore they don't know what's going on, so they can't object to it either. So there's something about representative government that has been lost in recent years because of the way they classify things, and that there are laws which says, yes, they can talk about classified material, especially when they're going to vote upon it. Well, a lot of times in the legislation that our elected officials vote upon, they don't even know what the classified material is that they're voting upon. So they can't speak to these programs and properly represent us. And I think there needs to be a shift here so that we become engaged in the process and not cut out of the process because of these rules.
Now, we know that Congressman Dennis Kucinich tried to introduce a bill, I believe, to the House back around, 2002 or 2003, that would limit weather warfare and warfare from space, but this bill did not get through the House. Is that correct?
That's correct. They changed the bill because the Pentagon wouldn't allow it to go through within its current wording form. So what happened is that because it was classified, they stripped the language out of the bill, and then it never went anywhere after that. But I think Dennis Kucinich was introducing some of what our government is working on and talking about, and a lot of it involves space, which doesn't surprise me, knowing what I know about some of the programs we're doing now.
Well, during the 1980s, some of us who are have been, you know, been around for a while remember that the government put an enormous amount of research dollars into the quote-unquote Star Wars program that Ronald Reagan envisioned, you know, this shield that would protect us from the nuclear missiles of the Russians. This has morphed into what we call the Strategic Defense Initiative. So you see a potential connection then between this Star Wars research and what is going on now?
Yes. Oh, absolutely.
And could
We have the money and the technology now to do it, and I think that that's some of the reasons that we're doing some of the experiments, atmospheric experiments that we're doing, is because we want to figure out how to do all of this. And so I think that it's definitely a military application.
So do you have any of that information on your website?
I will later this week. The CARE program is going to go up, and one of the things that the CARE program talks about is they want to protect, in other words, if someone put up some sort of explosion in space, that they wanted to protect their what they call our satellites or space assets from, in other words, this type of attack. And I looked at this, and I thought to myself very strangely that, well, if someone did that kind of attack, their own equipment and their own satellites would be just as disrupted as ours. So I felt that there was another reason for what they were trying to project here as far as why they were doing the CARE experiment. One of the reasons they were doing the CARE experiment. The University of Virginia has quite a lot of information on that, and I'm going to put it all up later this week on the agriculturaldefensecoalition.org site.
And that's the one that you were speaking of earlier that I asked the question on about took place in September. Is that correct?
Yes.
Okay.
So all my research is going to go up on to the agriculturaldefensecoalition.org site, which anyone can go to now. It has about 8,000 documents on it at the present time, and we're going to be adding another 18,000 within the next 2 weeks or so.
If I haven't got you linked, I'll certainly try to get that up there.
Okay, because you can go and you can do the search engine. Right now there's 325 articles about the U.S. Navy on there. There's Air Force articles. There's climate change articles. There's EPA, jet fuel emissions articles, all kinds of things on that website. And you can either scan it by page and then click on anything that you find of interest, or you can just type in words in the search engine and it will come up.
Well, if I could just go back to this weather warfare or space warfare connection, weather warfare, space warfare connection, do you envision that it's possible that a satellite could send electromagnetic weapons or beams, beam weapons down to a ionized plasma area of the atmosphere where they had done a lot of the additions, and that this could then what would be the effects then? Do you have any sense of how that would work?
I think that it would be devastating. They could pinpoint anyone anywhere on Earth and just in other words, just wipe them out. I think our technology, when you look at our weapon systems now and what we're capable of doing and the rush that we're putting through on some of these new systems, which is bothering me as well, to do it from space through the use of satellites and different things would be just a next juncture in world warfare and full dominance.
So obviously you found a lot of evidence to this back then.
That they're really interested in working on these things, doing the studies, yes. The universities are heavily engaged with military funding and also private funding in these fields. And if they get the private funding and they find something, it just shoots into a military application almost right away.
Yeah, and I suppose this would be an opportune moment to mention the document of the Air Force weather as a force multiplier, owning the weather by 2025. That's an Air Force document. You can download it off the computer. But there's also all of the Cheney defense directives that came out of when Cheney was defense Secretary of Defense in '92. And then this morphed into the neocon game plan, which I think came out around 2000-2001 under Bush, when Cheney, of course, was the vice president. And in these documents, they talk about, again, full spectrum dominance, complete control of space and cyberspace, having such an overwhelming military capacity that no other nation in the world would even dare to question the military superiority of the United States. So there's lots of documents that mention this goal of full spectrum dominance.
Well, there is this goal, but there's a low tech solution to this, and I've hesitated talking about it on the air, but I think I will tonight, only because the thing that bothers the satellites and it bothers everyone in space is space debris. So anytime there's an explosion in space, then they have all this debris, you know, floating around, which can impact the space station, could impact all these other things. So when anyone talks about having any explosions in space, that's the least that they want to do, because all that debris could bring down almost anything that's floating around and could ruin the satellites or do different things depending on the orbits. So, you know, we're talking about all this high tech and full spectrum dominance, and you know, anybody could shoot a rocket up loaded with rocks and explode it, and I can tell you that the havoc that would create would be tremendous at this particular juncture in time. And it's kind of stunning, but it's low tech, but they are so worried about all these rocks and these explosions. When the Russian satellite exploded and when we exploded one, they're having a problem with space debris. And so when they talk about having all this dominance and having all of these other things and being able to do this, that, and the other, because someone's going to put an explosion up there, I just can't believe it, because it would take down everyone's ability to use satellites and all kinds of things just by having space debris up there.
It would, I've read and heard that if once we get a certain amount of space debris in orbiting the Earth, it will be impossible to have these satellites. Isn't that correct?
It would be impossible, because they would be damaged beyond repair, because they have to be light enough to be able to, you know, solar panels and use the sun and do different things.
It would be colliding with debris that also is up there. Yeah.
Yeah. So part of this is that I think we want to have this dominance and have this full spectrum and be able to do all these things. But on the other hand, you've got other countries who are engaging in the same thing. So, you know, I don't know what the ultimate goal is particularly, except to have a few countries dominate so well that poor countries and the rest of us become, in other words, chattels of this monumental space thing that we're supposedly doing. And that's why I think that we need to get control of what we're doing in space and these experiments, and stop them before they go into any further, and say, look, we want to be informed. The public needs to decide whether this is a good idea, not just to use a space and our atmosphere as a physics laboratory for experiments. And I think we've gone much, much too far and intend to go too much further.
Rosalind, you had a couple of other things I want to bring up before we get too far into the program, or to the end of the program, and that was something about the DU or the depleted uranium, and then you had one. I think you wanted to also cover a little bit on the naval thing a little bit more. And I was, while I was at it, I was looking at one of the maps on there and realize that it isn't just, you know, the northwest coast that they're doing this. It looks like they pretty much cover most of our coasts.
The U.S. Navy warfare program, which also includes the Air Force, has divided the United States and its islands into warfare testing ranges. And starting in 2007, each of these ranges began to show up with an environmental impact statement, whether it was Florida or Southern California or Hawaii or the Marianas Islands in the Pacific or North and South Carolina, all of these ranges, and that map that you have that you refer to is online at californiaskywatch.com, but that map is online. It's a U.S. Navy map that you're referring to, and it shows all of these ranges all the way around the United States, but it also shows the ranges in Hawaii and some of the other islands that we control. And what happens is that each one of these has a five-year warfare testing program. A few started in 2007, a few started in 2008, and Northern California, Oregon, Washington, and Idaho, these are overland tests as well, ranges, and Washington, we're going to have sailed through and done their expansion, five-year expansion program, back in March and April of this year. However, we got wind of it, and some people in Oregon and myself got wind of this and decided that this wasn't such a good idea. So we decided that we didn't want the expansion into Northern California, since they were already bombing and had this expansion in Southern California and the Hawaiian Islands. And we found out that there was going to be decimated 11.7 million marine mammals from these warfare programs, 5 years each, on all the coasts, the Gulf of Mexico, the Atlantic, and the Pacific, and that they were going to be testing overland areas as well. Anyone can look at any of these environmental impact statements because they're online, because the Navy put them there due to a lawsuit. And some of them are engaged. You can read about what they're doing in your area. And, for example, there's the Northwest Training Range even has part of the state of Idaho involved in land exercises, along with Washington, Oregon, and possibly some in Northern California as well. So we're going to be used as experimental guinea pigs in the Navy and Air Force warfare testing programs. This is drones, sonic booms over land, surveillance programs, classified programs. This is bomb blasts. This is underwater detonations. This is everything. And all of these, except for the locations and the maps, almost all of the exercises that they will be conducting, and this is live fire exercises with real bombs, are redundant to a certain extent. So it means they're going to be doing the same type of sonar usage in all of these areas. They're going to be using the same type of weapon systems. They're going to be using depleted uranium. One of the things that Sheila Murray, the spokesman for the Navy, said to me was that when they get done using up the depleted uranium that they have, they're going to start using tungsten. But they were going to use up what was left of the depleted uranium in their warfare testing first. And there has been some discussion that maybe the Navy would stop using depleted uranium and store it somewhere, but then where are they going to put it? That's another question, because it's highly toxic. And to store it somewhere is also going to mean that it could cause problems. So we're curious about the several hundred toxic chemicals airborne. They've got white phosphorus, red phosphorus, airborne obscurants, aluminum-coated fiberglass, chaff that they're going to be using, and then a whole host of toxic chemicals, mercury, lead, arsenic, zinc. The list goes quite extensive, actually, of the different types of chemicals. You've got aluminum, you've got cadmium, chromium, copper, iron, lead, manganese, mercury, zinc, aromatic hydrocarbons, benzene, toluene, xylene, and naphthalene, which is a carcinogen, and barium chromate and hydrogen cyanide, and that's only a portion of the list.
So what are they doing, just getting rid of their waste?
Well, they're going to be doing detonations, they're going to be doing explosions, and they use these chemicals for their explosions, and they use them in some of the ordnance that's going to be left over in the oceans that they're going to just leave sit there as debris.
Well, one good example of, you know, why you might not want this going on is what they kind of left the Island Vieques. Didn't the Navy have that as a testing area for quite a while?
Oh, sure. And they left it a wreck. Absolutely a wreck. From all of the testing that they did there, they never cleaned it up all the way. We have a pretty bad history of not cleaning up when we've done military testing, and this is historical. And many areas, they say that if all of the stuff washes from the oceans onto land, that the counties and the states will have to clean them up themselves at their expense. The Navy is not necessarily going to leave anything that they think is valuable, but the rest of the debris they have no intention of cleaning up. But I want to read you this brief note from Senator Boxer and Senator Feinstein. There's some other senators from Oregon that signed this as well. It's a June 19th, 2009 letter to NOAA, U.S. Department of Commerce. And this is in part what it says, and this is just a few sentences. In many regions, the Navy plans to increase the number of its exercises or expand the areas in which they may occur, and virtually every coastal state will be affected. Some exercises may occur in the nation's most biologically sensitive marine habitats, including national marine sanctuaries and breeding habitats. In all, the Navy anticipates more than 2.3 million takes. That's a definition for U.S. Department of Commerce, which could mean, and I'll define it for you, it means harass, hunt, capture, kill, collect, or attempt to harass, hunt, capture, kill, or collect, shoot, wound, trap, or attempt to engage in any such conduct. And it says here in the letter, to continue, in all, the Navy anticipates more than 2.3 million takes, significant disruptions in marine mammal foraging, breeding, and other essential behaviors per year, or 11.7 million takes over the course of a five-year permit. And
take, is that the word takes, T-A-K-E?
That's the word take.
Okay.
And it's a U.S. Department of Commerce definition of take that I read to you. And you can look it up under National Marine Fisheries Service definitions, and they'll give you the definition of take. Mm-hmm. Now, take sounds very mild, but it isn't. And then there's letters from the Oregon senators saying that it's going to disrupt millions of dollars worth of fishing and habitat destruction. And right now, the Northwest Training Range in California, the Navy's looking to finish the final for their environmental impact statement in December of this year. And the permit from the National Marine Fisheries Service to allow this take or the harming of marine mammals is expected to come out in January or February of next year. Now, we've delayed them some, but we need to put a halt to this whole project. And so,
well, what about the potential danger to humans?
Well, we don't count. fish like salmon don't count. Marine habitats don't count. The toxic chemicals don't count that they're going to use. The airborne obscurants like red and white phosphorus, which they're going to be using as airborne for airborne testing, they're banned by the Geneva Convention. They're horrible, horrible chemicals, and they bioaccumulate in the marine food chain. But we don't count. The public doesn't count. Human health doesn't count.
It seems like warfare against the civilian population, which, of course, is forbidden by the Geneva Accords, et cetera. It seems like warfare against the American people.
That's right. The Navy is going to conduct warfare against us and testing on all of our oceans.
Okay.
And it's not low-intensity warfare. This is warfare.
This is warfare, yes. This
when
is
you...
high intensity. And this is they're going to throw everything, all the military equipment and future equipment that they have, they're going to throw into these military programs all the way around the United States, every coastal area.
Essentially, what this would be doing, it would be killing any of the shipping areas off of the coast of the United States, and it looks to me like it would be leaving open the ones that they're wanting to open up, and in Mexico and Panama.
Could be, but they're going to test in the Gulf of Mexico as well. So I don't think anything is truly safe. And they're already testing in Southern California.
Okay,
so
but what I'm talking about is way down around the I can't even say the name of the town, Los Cardenas?
Yes.
Okay, and then the one at Panama Canal, are they going to be doing that down in those areas?
I don't think so.
Okay, so that would leave them, if they're going to be building this Trans-Texas Corridor or open, and if they're trying to kill off our shipping business.
Well, I don't know. I think that they would kill off. I don't know if they're going to kill off our shipping business. I think what they're looking to do is to allow the shipping lanes to be open for commerce for now. But I think that the war is on the Pacific Ocean, and there are other testing.
Okay. Or fishing areas.
Or fishing. Yes. I don't see how the Navy. I don't see how the Air Force. The Air Force says, oh, we can fly over. It's interesting. You watch the permit from the National Marine Fisheries Service to allow the Air Force to go ahead and bomb the ocean. And the Air Force just has to fly over and say, oh, it's free. We don't see anything in the Gulf of Mexico. We don't see any manatees. We don't see any whales. We don't see anything, and therefore we can just go in and drop our bombs. So, you know, the whole mitigation measures is a joke. It's only effective about 20% of the time, because they're going to build these platforms on ships, and then they're going to, if someone can see a mammal, well, then they're going to stop these multi-million-dollar testing programs. But then if that was true, they wouldn't need a permit from the National Marine Fisheries Service to decimate these marine mammals. And if you read their information, they talk about sea turtles. And they said, well, if sea turtles are there and bombs go off, the sea turtles can just swim somewhere else. And I thought, they're migrating. They're not going to be able to swim somewhere else. And a platform on a ship is not going to be able to particularly see them either. So the impossibility of bomb blasts at night and them seeing marine mammals and all these other things from a platform on a ship is absolutely ridiculous, because you've got fogs and smokes and all these other things going on. The odds of, and waves, and dark seas, your odds of seeing very much are pretty slim to begin with.
Now, Senators Boxer and Feinstein made this statement. Was this an objection to the proposed exercises, or what? Just a clarification, or what?
No, it said here, we are hopeful that NOAA's review will identify effective measures to minimize environmental impacts and improve monitoring of affected populations. Such measures include the establishment of firm seasonal or geographical sonar exclusion areas to protect vulnerable species and habitat. We appreciate your consideration of this important matter and your efforts to improve the health of our oceans. The only thing that they're talking about, though, with this whole entire letter is the use of sonar. They're not talking about the bomb blasts, and they're not talking about the toxic chemicals. They're not talking about human health impacts, nothing. And so they want a strong review process. But it says, under the circumstances, it is essential that the U.S. Department of Commerce prescribe mitigation measures that substantially reduce impacts on marine wildlife and habitat while allowing the Navy to train effectively. But then why does the Navy need to train in the Atlantic, the Pacific, the Gulf of Mexico, Hawaii, Alaska, and all these places where they intend to train if they're not already blowing up those areas with bomb blasts and using sonar on marine mammals?
Sounds almost like ecocide, you know, just destroying the ecosystem.
Well, how can you have the White House Agency Task Force, a body that was created by President Obama to preserve the oceans, and yet sitting on the task force is the United States Navy representative, who knows fully well that they're going to be blowing up the oceans and affecting every coastal community, who sits there and says, well, it's national security, we're just going to blow up everything while we practice in national security mode. But this isn't security for us. This is war.
Yeah.
This is practice on us. This is war on us. And when we escalate, and everybody knows that we're doing this, you think that other countries aren't going to start doing this too? I mean, this just escalates the cold hot war again, as we escalate our military endeavors. And think about the cost of all this. I mean, one blowing up one Hellfire missile costs $58,000, and that's a conservative estimate. And they're going to blow up thousands of them in the oceans, along with all these other ones. If anyone wants to read what the Navy intends, a good environmental impact statement is at www.nwtrangecomplexeis.com. That's www.nwtrangecomplexeis.com.
Now, when is the Navy hoping to start this program?
Well, in Southern California, you're already engaged. The bomb blasts have been heard out over the Pacific by people who live in Southern California. You've already gotten a couple of sonic booms over there over land, and they've already started the Southern California Range Complex training has already began, and they're doing the bomb blasts and all these things.
Are they getting a lot of dead fish and that sort of thing?
Well, we're beginning to see along the shoreline starving animals showing up, starving birds. We're beginning to see beachings more and more. And so the Navy and the idea is to say, well, you know, the oceans are in trouble, and we know, and we have to save the oceans, and that's where the environmental groups are for the most part. But we want to know, is this a direct result of this Navy testing? And the Navy testing is supposed to start in Northern California, probably. The sonar is being used now, according to Congressman Thompson of our district in Northern California, District 1. And according to all of our estimates, as soon as the National Marine Fisheries Service, NOAA, issues a permit, then the Navy will start the bomb blasts and start expanding into Northern California and other areas, probably in December or January next year.
There's something strange about this EIS statement. I mean, how in the... it flies in the face of what it would be supposedly for. Does it not?
I mean, yes, it does.
Okay.
But the Navy hired private contractors to write their environmental impact statement, saying that even though there were problems, and even though they're going to impact birds and fish and sea turtles and all these things, the Navy takes the position that they have to practice for war. And therefore, in order to be well-trained and well-practiced, they have to have all these different ranges all around the United States, and they have to practice the same tests in all of those ranges in order to be prepared for war. And I'm going, well, shouldn't we be preparing, saving money and preparing for something else? Imagine the military budget blowing up? You know, they don't have to do live fire exercises. They can practice without blowing up actual bombs that we have to replace at taxpayers' expense.
Well, there is no enemy that we need to do these drills to learn how to protect ourselves from. I can say that. I think I can say that. I mean, we are the world superpower. So if we are conducting these exercises, it has a different goal. And do you think it's connected to all our earlier conversation with the weather modification and space warfare?
Sure, I do, because the Navy just did this CARE project on September 19th, and they're going to do more. And you see they just shoved it out into the public realm and said, well, we're going to have this experiment. And no discussion of the impact on human health, no discussion of the impact on this cloud going up. And in other words, taking the sunlight, maybe diffusing it, or so that we get less sunlight as this cloud expands, this dust cloud of aluminum oxide expands. I think that they just have the money and they can do the experiments, and there's no controls, and the public has no idea what's going on. None, for the most part. I mean, people are shocked when they see the map.
Yeah.
And when I first saw the map, I just knew about the Northwest Training Range. I just knew about California, Oregon, Washington, and Idaho. And you can see from the map, by the way, anybody can go online and see this map. But if you look at the map over this area that I'm talking about, it looks like a big range that's there. And the Navy was making the claim individually that, well, we just need these little areas to expand into practice because the Navy needs to practice. Well, then all of a sudden, I was told by Sheila Murray, the Navy contact that we had, Navy spokesman, that, well, they were practicing already in Southern California, and they were already bombing, you know, in Hawaii. And then I began to ask my congressman, well, can you tell me all the places that the Navy are practicing? And then I got this map, which is actually a Navy map, and I started looking at it, and I go, there's no area that they're not practicing in. And then I found out that there were environmental impact statements all about the same, just different species.
All whitewashes, yeah.
And
I've seen that, how that works.
And just different species. And what I noticed is that the environmental groups weren't engaged. They were telling me that, you know, I should save the polar bear and contribute, or I should save, you know, I should save, you know, the manatees, or I
yeah.
should save the blue dolphin or something. And I looked at this and I thought, well, why am I bothering to send them any money to save them from fishing or something when the Navy is going to be blowing them all up all around in all oceans, the Atlantic, the Pacific, and the Gulf of Mexico? What's going to be left? And I thought, where are these environmental groups at the grassroots level out putting a stop to this?
I think there's a very, very good case to be made for the fact that the big major environmental groups have been co-opted, that the people who sit on the boards of the major corporations also now sit on the boards of the environmental groups. So they essentially work together to achieve common goals. That's my experience anyway. But let me ask you this, Rosalind. Do you think that the weather modification programs, certainly as the military is involved, might constitute in some ways a kind of low-intensity warfare against the civilian population?
I think they all do. Because we don't have any consent. We don't have any way to protect agriculture. We don't have any way to protect our water supplies from these testing. So whether a private individual is doing it, a university, a county, a city, a state, private corporation, or the military does these programs, we have no idea what the synergistic effects are, and they're experimenting on us. And some of them may be experimenting without knowing what the guy down the street or in the next state is doing as well. So their tests could be malfunctioning just because they don't know all the other tests that are ongoing, because there's no real reporting requirement or public notification requirement at all.
I guess when I use the word low-intensity warfare, it implies a deliberate attempt to subvert the health of a civilian population, perhaps which would be a little bit different than just experimenting or trying to get some commercial advantage by weather modification.
Oh, I think it's all involved.
It's all involved.
But I think that what better place to experiment is than putting it here, just like the Navy's doing, just putting it here in the United States to experiment on us. In other words, we can be the guinea pigs, and they don't have to tell us what's going on. They can just say that they're saving us, and I don't know what they're saving us from, but it's a way to perfect their techniques.
Can I also bring up, looking at this map, that the area that they seem to dominate here would really channel in the ability of us to get any kind of shipping or control the shipping lanes that would go out because of these testing areas, correct?
It could.
Okay.
I just don't know. I just know that when they're engaged in the testing, that the shipping lanes I don't know. They'd have to allow the ships to go through or not. The way it looks is that practically every ocean area of the United States, and we're working in conjunction with Canada in a few areas as well. So, but it's staggering. I mean, I look at how much they're doing, and you can figure that the results of their tests don't stay within the ranges. The sonar goes outside of the ranges. Mid and high frequency sonar can travel miles beyond the range itself. And also, the bomb blasts and the habitat destruction of migrating marine mammals can affect populations in South America and Canada and Alaska and all over.
Now, this map doesn't represent either that the other branches of the military that are taking over areas inside the country. I've heard of areas around, this one may be showing some of that around Arizona, or that could be California, I'm not quite sure. But I do know some areas around Phoenix and that they're expanding, and then of course the southeast quadrant of Colorado has been expanded considerably if they get finished their Pinyon Canyon project.
Well, what happens is if you get a United States Department of Commerce flight map, FAA flight map, for pilots, uh-huh. They're available at any airport for about $10 each. And you can get a map of any section of the United States, which gives you fly zones and where the military bases are located. And what is interesting about these maps is they give you the military operations areas inside the United States. And they just show them because they're in areas where you can't fly. And so, for example, in the area where I live, we have Maxwell 3 Military Operations Area. And then if you go north of us, you have Maxwell 2 Military Operations Area. And that goes into California. And then it starts to go out into other states. But then you've got Lake County, which has Maxwell 1 Military Operations Areas. And as you move across the United States, you have the China Military Operations Area. You have the Whitmore Military Operations Area. So you can get any section of the United States that you want, showing different California ranges or Oregon or Washington or Colorado ranges. And you can see where all of the aerial military operations areas are.
So have they expanded a lot since they first started having that sort of the flight areas?
We weren't told here in Mendocino County. As far as I can go back, we never voted, and we were never told we were within a military operations area. I just happened to find out and was told that about 40 years ago, these military operation areas were put in, but I don't think we had any vote or had any say in whether we wanted a military operations area here or not. So I think that they have begun to expand over the years, and you can't find out much about the military operations areas or what they do. However, you can tell because pilots won't fly in those areas or in certain heights, and they're restricted. So you do know that they're conducting military operations. And I just don't like the idea that they have one set up over Mendocino County. Absolutely just don't like it at all. And don't feel that the public or the state were warned that there was going to be this military operations area without the public consent.
And where does the Mendocino County encompass? Is it into the San Joaquin Valley and that sort?
Oh, no. We're miles. Oh, my.
Okay.
No. No, we're 120 miles north of San Francisco, U.S. Highway 101. And we're definitely in the heart of Northern California along the coast.
Okay.
And Mendocino County is a very large county. When you come down from Oregon, you're about 4 hours from driving from the Oregon border to get to Ukiah. And so what happens is that in that area, coming down, you have three counties, and we're one of the big counties coming down the coastline and going inland many miles.
Okay. I don't have, it doesn't show the counties on this, but I was just curious. And is it far, how far is it from San Francisco? Is it a pretty good ways?
120 miles driving up US 101, the major highway.
Okay.
Going north.
Okay.
Well, this conversation took a turn towards the military, which was very interesting, and I can see how the study of the quote unquote persisting jet contrails and starting for you with agriculture, and then the weather modification experiments, and then the military have all kind of been of a piece for you. But going back to the agriculture, if we could for a second,
sure.
Rosalind, do you have access to studies that show a declined yield in any sort of experimental way that can be attributed to reduced solar radiation?
Yes, the University of Illinois has done some studies on that, and also. There's a lot more interest being paid to this now. There's a couple of studies underway at the moment, which are beginning to really determine that when you take away direct sunlight, and you put in increased cloud cover, and all other factors being equal, that, crop production is down. So yes, there is. The other issue here I can say is, even though we've swung far afield, is that a lot more people are looking up to see the jets now, because they're seeing that this Navy program is real. And when they notice that this Navy program is real and that the weather modification bill is real about expanding weather mitigation without our consent, more people are beginning to look up and see the jets and looking at it in a different light and saying, yes, if they are willing to do all these experiments, why not? So it's kind of changed the course of things. And I think, though, that no one understands the implication of what all these things are going to mean to agriculture and our food supply. And I can tell you that where 3 years ago we were a net exporter of food, the United States now needs to import food from other countries in order to keep up with the food that we need here in this country.
Oh, boy, that's a big milestone.
We're a stretch into being a net importer of food instead of a net exporter of food. So we're no longer in a place where a lot of our food stores, where we used to send the food to needy areas in other countries, our supplies are dwindling or have really dwindled to practically nothing, so that we have very little in backup storage in food. Where we used to have huge storage silos that had extra food that used to go into school programs and used to go in a lot of places, and those are beginning to be impacted now because we're producing less of our own food.
Wow.
Yeah, it was Earl Butz who was the Secretary of Agriculture under Kennedy. I remember this because Wendell Berry made the quoted him as saying, "This is the Secretary of Agriculture, mind you. Food is a weapon." And, of course, what he was referring to is how the U.S. Government and our State Department could use food as a weapon by trading it with some nations and refusing to give food aid to other nations. And I suppose that karma could reverse that process, and the food could be used as a weapon against the American people if we are not self-sufficient in food.
Well, if you cut down the amount of sunlight reaching the earth, you're going to have lower crop production. And if you begin to disrupt the microclimates from weather modification programs, that's a climate that's different than a similar climate in another county or region that allows the production of certain types of crops. And if you start throwing the weather out of kilter because of your experiments, crop production has already dropped and will continue to drop. And so we need to get control. That's why we need to get control of these experiments before they get any more out of hand, so that we can bring crop production back to what it was versus limping along with having all these experimental programs, which is reducing crop production and reducing the amount of sunlight that reaches the earth. So plants and trees can grow healthy and strong instead of being weak and not having enough energy to grow.
May I mention one other thing that we haven't equated to that? It's got to be affecting the water sources and in the amounts of water, would it not?
Absolutely.
So it could be a way of controlling water or water warfare, too.
That's very correct, and that's why Siskiyou County up north, northeast of us, fought off PG&E late last year and early this year, stopped a weather modification program that would have taken their snow and rainfall and delivered it elsewhere. And they said, no, you can't come in here and you can't change our weather and you can't seed our clouds and do what you're going to do to put snow or rainfall somewhere else. We're going to keep it here for what crops and what we have here and our watersheds. So, but that's only because they found out from a KTVU Channel 2 Oakland San Francisco television station that this was going on and were able to, and found out that their supervisors had approved it. And then there was a public uprising and PG&E bowed out. But PG&E is quite fond of saying that if they want to increase the amount of rain or snow by 15% or 10%, that they can do it, which means that they would take that rainfall or snow away from another area that might need it just as badly.
Okay, before we try to wrap this up, I just want to say this is KHEN-LPFM Radio, 106.9 Salida, Colorado, and this is Truth Quest with Melody with our co-host, Dr. Eric Carlstrom, and our guest, Rosalind Peterson. So, you know, this is something that people need to be paying attention to, obviously, and it's hitting us in just about every avenue that you could think of, it sounds like.
Well, I have a question, Melody, maybe a good one to wrap up on, and that is Rosalind gave us kind of some cause for hope there, which is that with the weather modification bill and with the Navy program, people are starting to wake up and look up in the sky, and they're starting to get active. Now, could you just elaborate on that, Rosalind, as a kind of a last note? What is happening nationwide in terms of citizen activism, and how can people hope to affect this topic in a positive way?
Well, one of the things that they can do now is that they have access to many of the documents, for example, that we talked about on my websites. They have access to looking up the information for themselves and seeing the actual studies in the documents so that they can look at it, know that it's going on. The second thing is in joining the Bonfire Coalition or in joining others who are working on these projects from different avenues is that you can join with other people and begin to educate your elected officials and begin to show them the documents and begin to force them to address these issues. And as people are beginning to realize that what we're talking about is real, that there is a real Senate bill we have to go after and defeat, U.S. Senate Bill 601 or 1733, and the reasons for it, then they begin to really have some actions that they can take. And people who are really interested are beginning to now start to take action, and we're beginning to see more and more of this as the discussion goes forward. So I'm hopeful along that in that area.
Yeah, me too. And lastly, I do have a couple classes that I'm teaching here at the university. Because, as you know, perhaps in California, we're going through our budget crises here. And one of the ways that the state is trying to save money is put state employees on furlough. So 10% of my salary I'm not getting 10% of my salary, and I'm supposed to work 10% less. That means that we have some furlough days, and what I've done with some of my students is have them listen to some of the interviews that we've done, and I'd kind of like to have them listen to this one. I'm not sure that the last half hour about military stuff is something that they're psychologically prepared for. what is your comment on that?
Well, they have to begin somewhere to know what's going on, and so you might want to, you know, give them some idea that these are some things that are happening which are going to affect them and why, and that they can learn something by listening and they can do some research on it. And, you know, just like you could use, not only do they listen, but you can ask them to do some research on a subject that they're interested in and write a paper.
Yeah.
And I would suggest that. And also, I'm perfectly willing to send you my PowerPoint presentation on this.
That'd be great.
That I did for the United Nations. I'll update a little bit of it, and I can send it to you so that you can let them look at that, too.
That would be very much appreciated, because I think it would... Yeah, it would give them the factual basis that I think that they would need to kind of digest this some of this stuff. Yeah. So.
Well, I think too that students, even though it's difficult, they need to know that there are programs that are going to affect them and their lives. And I think it's good that they start to have be in the decision-making process for that. And that's part of education, is to know what's going on in the current events. And to begin to research it and come up with their own ideas and what they think about it, too.
Eric,
yeah.
I don't see how this wouldn't affect, involve, if you're dealing with environmentalism, and it's just how the military fits into it. Maybe.
Maybe. Well, it's hard to know. And so, but I think exposure is a good thing. At least then when they hear it from somewhere else, they'll say, I know something about that.
Yeah.
And so there's an exposure thing. But you can give them half to listen to it one time and half some other time.
Yeah.
I don't know.
Well, Rosalind, I want to really thank you for coming on the program again. You've done a great job again of presenting, you know, your research. And Dr. Carlstrom, do you want to give us a little bit of information about your guests that we're going to have on next week before we go?
Yeah, and I would just, before I do that, Melody, I'll just say for our listeners, if anyone has been able to hang in with us, it's been a very interesting program. But we've also done a previous interview on with Rosalind on the 5th of May, so that's on your archive, so I would recommend that they listen to that. I've actually written up some notes from that, and I'll send them to you, Melody, as soon as I can. You can post those, too. Next week... we are going to, hopefully, I think we're going to try to get one of the professors on my campus, California State University, Stanislaus, who is with the California Faculty Association Union. And so he will be a wealth of information as to what's been going on in terms of our state university system over the last, 15, 20 years, and what's going on right now with the budget crisis and how the budget crisis is being used to affect some radical changes to our university. And I think that sometimes, so, as California goes, so goes the nation. I think what we're looking at is almost kind of a Walmart downsizing and an attempt to push us into the, technology age. In other words, more computer courses, less actual professors, while some of that might be good, we might be risking losing the kind of personal education, liberal education that most of us were lucky enough to receive. So it should be very interesting. It'll be Dr. Steve Filling, and so hopefully we'll be talking to him next Tuesday night.
Well, again, I want to thank you both for coming on the program and say good night.
Yeah, thank you, Rosalind. It was very informative. Appreciate it, and I would like to hear get a look at that PowerPoint if I could. So,
send me an email, and
yeah.
I'll with an address I can send it to.
Yeah, we'll do it. Okay. Good night.
Good night.
Yeah, thanks,
good night.
Melody. Bye-bye.
Bye.